Foreign buyers are making it hard for locals to buy homes in Miami, and the mother of Trayvon Martin is running for Miami-Dade County Commission. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Sabrina Fulton is one of two candidates so far to be in the running for a seat on the Miami-Dade County Commission. She's the mother of Trayvon Martin, the young man killed by a neighborhood watch guard in Sanford, Florida in 2012. We'll talk with Ms. Fulton about her campaign and the issue of gun violence. Also, one of the reasons that Miami has become a difficult place to buy a home, foreign buyers. We'll talk with the folks at the Miami Herald about a new series called Priced Out of Paradise. And Miami-Dade and Broward still have the highest rates of new HIV cases. There's a group that's using a dating app to try and help reverse those figures. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, for anyone who's lived in Miami or South Florida, for that matter, for the past few decades, you've seen how much this area has changed. A lot. Roads and highways have expanded, and yet they're still packed. High-rises are popping up everywhere. There is little empty space left to build on. And of course, prices for homes just keep climbing and climbing. The Miami Herald is publishing a series called Priced Out of Paradise. It looks at what Miami used to be and what it's become and why. And a big part of the story, foreign investment. Joining me now is one of the Miami Herald reporters on this series, Renee Rodriguez, joining us from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald in Doral. Renee, great to have you on, man.
Thanks for having me, Louis.
This is not a new story, but what did you and the Miami Herald want to do with it this time around?
There's kind of been a perfect storm where the situation has reached such a crisis point that you have county government, you have city government, you have grassroots activist groups, and then you have nonprofit groups like Miami Homes for All. They're all coming together, University of Miami, FIU, to kind of try to address the problem in ways that haven't been done before. And it's a national epidemic. Each city has its own set of particular rules and factors as to why this has happened. But this felt like the right time because I feel like we are on the verge of some kind of change.
The series looks back at Miami, going back to the 80s and 90s, and then into the aughts, arrives some change. And a lot of it seemed to happen under then-Miami Mayor Manny Diaz. But when did the foreign investment become part of this picture?
Well, you have to remember the foreign investment has been part of Miami ever since. If you go back to the 1980s, if you ever watch the movie Cocaine Cowboys,
right.
That movie makes a really convincing argument that the Miami downtown skyline, as we used to know it back in the 80s, was built up by cocaine money. Except back then, the foreign investors, what they would do is they would just launder their money through banks here in Miami, and those banks would finance construction projects, et cetera. But it's been a gradual thing. It wasn't just after the recession. There's a group of developers here in Miami called the Mello Group, which is a father and two sons. They're from Argentina. And they bought their first plot of land here in Edgewater in 2001. So it's been a gradual interest by foreign buyers. And the more foreign buyers that come in, the more of their neighbors they attract.
And so over time, we've seen, again, the changes in the 90s, really. And then, of course, leading up to and after the recession is when, you start to see, the construction just grow. And you start to see, again, more money flushed into the system and building it up. But, when did you start to see, I guess, people from Latin America, South America come in and start buying up a lot of property because they wanted to hide their money?
That really came, the big uptick came right after the 2008 recession. You have to remember that Florida was ground zero for the housing crisis. There were so many bad loans that were made here in Florida in particular for homeowners, and a lot of people lost their homes. They went into foreclosures. And that's where you start seeing a big influx of investors who would just buy these underwater properties at a bargain. And they also started buying land because it was very cheap. That's where you start seeing a big uptick. And then after the recession, you had all these developers who had started construction on their towers, and all of a sudden, boom, like, what are you going to do? Like, who's going to buy this? It was foreign buyers who would come in and say, I'll give you 50% down cash right now. And they kind of rescued the real estate industry from the brink of disaster, but it also started making the real estate industry cater to those rich foreigners instead of the people here.
Do these foreign buyers, do they actually live in the properties even part-time, or are they just buying up space? Is it just an investment to hold money?
That's starting to change. Back then, it really was largely just for them to park money and launder money, to be honest. But as the city has grown, now it's not just rich foreign people who are moving here. Now it's just regular working class people who may have a business in Venezuela, but because of what Miami has become, and many of them say they move here because they want their kids to study here. So now you have just people who are competing with you for that same $300,000 home. And now it's not just about the million-dollar penthouses.
And what do we know about the prevalence of Airbnb among foreign buyers? Are they buying up properties and using them as short-term rentals? Do we know anything about that?
That's actually going to be it's a really, really interesting question. And that's actually going to be part of our second phase of Priced Out of Paradise. But to answer your question in a very short way, yes, the number of rental units that are being taken off the market and converted into Airbnb is staggering. And that contributes to the scarcity of affordably priced rentals.
Has the city, has the county, has the area ever considered putting caps on rents?
That has to be done at a state legislative level. It can't be done on a city or county level. That has to be something that the state regulates. And, there's rent control and rent capping. It's a very controversial subject. Some people say it works. Some people say it doesn't. But that has to come as a state mandate. The city itself can't do it.
Would it also be, I don't know if anybody's ever talked about rules that would put pressure on buyers to say, look, you're going to buy a place, but you've got to spend some time in it. You can't just have an empty space, right? I mean, that's been discussed as well.
Yes, and that is actually on the table again. So an interesting comparison is Vancouver had a huge, huge number of Chinese investors who wanted to take their money out of their country, and they started buying properties in Vancouver because there was that long centuries old connection between the two countries. But the situation got so dire that Vancouver has passed a vacancy tax. And basically what it says is if your property is vacant more than 6 months out of the year, you're going to have to pay a tax, or you can put it into the market and rent it out as market rate. And it seems to be working. I believe their first year they generated something like $88 million worth. And that's one of the things that the city of Miami is going to be contemplating, and it's this big affordable housing master plan that they're going to release probably in a couple of weeks.
And I guess that's how you monitor if people are actually doing it, right? It's through the tax.
Right, it's through the tax, and you can monitor it in all kinds of ways. You can monitor it like power usage, like electricity. There are a lot of very easy ways. So it incentivizes the foreign investor to, instead of keeping their unit empty, to put it back on the market. Like, I mean, why not?
And I don't want to, because I don't have anybody in real estate here to speak for, I guess, that group, and it's not about attacking them, but I mean, I'm also imagining, look, if you could sell a place and make a nice profit, why would you care how it's being used, right?
That's right. I mean, we live in a capitalist society, and at the end of the day, the market demand is what sets prices. It's not a market reality. It's what people are willing to pay. And if you're a real estate broker, I mean, you're just doing a job.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Rene Rodriguez. The Herald is publishing a series. It's called Priced Out of Paradise. They already have some of the stories out now. And it looks again at how and why the city of Miami has become one of the most expensive places to live. And it's kind of pricing out locals. And you can find links at our social media at WLRN.org or at WLRN Sundial. Again, so you can check out some of those stories. Rene is joining us from the studios of WLRN in the Miami Herald in Doral. Can we tell, Renee, how many of the towers in Miami or Miami Beach or even some of the neighboring communities are because of foreign investment? Because you talked about how, and that was always the joke back in the 80s, like a lot of the city was built on cocaine. It was built on the cocaine trade. But when we look at the towers that are popping up now, why? Why so many towers?
Again, the market is there. And you have to remember that land costs right now are higher than ever, right? Construction costs are higher than ever. Parts, the standards to which you have to build these buildings to meet, you know, zoning requirements and hurricane proof. You know, it's very expensive to build these big condo towers. But there's also a market that is willing to, more than happy to buy these units. They wouldn't have built them if they didn't have a market.
Well, I'm thinking about that. And so look, maybe you know about this one, but I think about that there's a tower right across the parking lot from the studios. And it's I believe it's called Canva. And it's been there now for a couple of years. And I've seen some of the rental towers pop up around us. And those are rentals. The Canva, I believe, is those are condos for sale. The rental apartments are filling up because at night, as I'm walking home, I could see lights. I could see people living in them. I see people coming out of the building. But the Canva building looks dark. And I'm thinking, has anybody bought anything? And we've reported on stories. You've seen the stories of places that are empty.
Yeah, Canvas. It's actually called Canvas.
Canvas. Thank you. Sorry.
That's a unique building because it's in the middle of the Arts and Entertainment District. They have, if you ever go in there, every different floor, they basically let artists to just do these amazing murals on the hallways. It's a really cool building. But what's unique about that one is it is condominiums, but they were priced at, they are not luxury priced. So the smallest units, I believe, started at around $385,000. Now, that's for 600 square feet, right? So it's attainable, but it's 600 square feet. And they go up to about $500,000. But that building actually opened at the end of last year, I believe. And it was 90% sold. So it may look dark at night, but that building has been a success.
It has. Okay. It's just strange I'm walking home, at night, and I don't see a lot of lights. I see only a few. I mean, I was counting. There's just like barely less than half a dozen.
Yeah. And that's something that a vacancy tax or a vacancy fee, like whatever you want to call it, could help, you know, because if the guy who bought that lives in Vermont, you know, why not put that apartment up for rent?
Is Miami really hurting? If you think about, okay, the demand is there and you've got foreign buyers coming in. Obviously, it hurts locals because, you know, if you got foreign buyers, especially coming in with cash, that's going to hurt a lot of folks locally. But, I mean, politicians, would they care? If the money's there and their coffers are growing, do they care?
Yes, they care because you can't just look at the foreign buyers. You have to, obviously have to look at the people who live in your city. And so the area median income for Miami-Dade County for families, okay, so that's household income. The area median income for Miami-Dade County is $54,000. So think about that for a minute. And then the rule of thumb is that you should only be paying 30% of your monthly income to rent. Or if you're purchasing a house, you should only buy a house that's priced at three times your annual salary. Okay.
Yeah.
Following those basic standards, pretty much almost 80% of the people who live in Miami are cost burdened because we're paying more than a third of our monthly income for rent, and we're definitely paying more than three times our annual income for home purchases.
Yeah, and I want to be careful not to say that politicians don't care. I think that, you know, it's, again, because the investment has been there, the city has grown. And that also means that tax revenue has grown. And so that's good for the city. It's good for the county. But at the same time, as you've pointed out, the Herald has pointed out, we've pointed out for a long time, there is a class of people who they work in service jobs, the teachers, the police officers, the firemen, so many people who can't afford it. Because the cost is going up so fast. And part of the series, too, I do want to point out, this I think was some of the other stories, is that income hasn't kept up with that growth. What have you heard from readers so far about what you've reported?
The most common sentiment that I've gotten is that they are so happy because we've been able to show with data what they've been feeling about living in this city. And it's weird. If you've lived in Miami for a while and you are a teacher or a nurse or a fireman or something, it feels very strange to all of a sudden not be able to afford the place where you've been working and living for so long. And, you know, to answer your previous question about why we should care, you know, we have a teacher shortage in Florida, right?
Yeah, yeah,
and
we do.
And part of the reason is because it doesn't pay enough. Why would you become a teacher if you can't even going to be able to afford your rent? And that's where it starts affecting quality of life. You're right, the service and hospitality industry in Miami is the biggest job there is, a job generator. And those are some of the lowest paying jobs. So eventually something has to give.
You did mention a little while ago, there's still more to come in the series. But again, can you just tease up a little bit about some of the stuff that we can expect to see?
Sure. So my next piece is going to take a deep dive into affordable housing, which is not what people think it is. When you think about affordable housing, the average person thinks, oh, it's welfare, it's public housing, it's a handout. And no, affordable housing is housing that is affordable to the average median resident and the importance of it. We've interviewed people who live in these affordable housing units, and we've also gone into a couple of workforce housing buildings. So we want to show readers exactly what affordable housing is, what workforce housing is, and why it is so important from a basic Miami perspective. And it's also really good business, which people don't realize. They think it's just tax driven or anything. No, it's a bipartisan thing.
It's a fascinating series. Again, we will have more information on our website, WLRN.org, and on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Renee Rodriguez, one of the Miami Herald reporters working on the series, Priced Out of Paradise. Renee, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks, Louis.
All right, still to come, we're going to meet one of the candidates running for Miami-Dade County Commission in District 1. Sabrina Fulton joins us. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Sabrina Fulton is fully committed to the issue of combating gun violence and supporting families of those who've lost a loved one to a shooting. She lost her son, Trayvon Martin, back in 2012. The story gained national attention as the shooter, George Zimmerman, was later acquitted of the charges. Fulton started the Trayvon Martin Foundation that same year and continues the work to this day. She recently announced her candidacy for the Miami-Dade County Commission. She's running for District Seat 1 against Miami Gardens Mayor Oliver Gilbert. Mrs. Fulton joins us now in studio. It is a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this. Why do you want to run for Miami-Dade County Commission?
One of the things that reasons why I want to run is because I want to make sure that I'm representing the people of Miami-Dade County. I work with Miami-Dade County government for over 20 years, about 24 years until the untimely death of my son through this tragedy. And since that time, I have been, you know, traveling a lot to different cities, to different communities and meeting with different people. And one of the things I thought about myself is to make sure I take care of home first. And so that's why I want to bring my talent, bring everything, my experience from working with the county over 20 years, bring that back to Miami-Dade County. I'm a people's person, and I believe that I could be the voice for the people. I don't consider myself a career politician. I don't want to fall into that category because usually career politicians, you see pretty much hear the same things, you see the same things, and nothing changed. So I'm going to bring that fresh new eyes and fresh new ideas, fresh new vision to District 1 so that people can have some type of hope for change.
And you, as you said, you had been working with Miami-Dade County Public Works for many years, right?
Well, I work with public housing.
Public housing.
So that's one of my platforms as well. I'm interested in affordable housing, homeownership, rentals, and things like that, making sure that those things are affordable for people who live in District 1, and not just District 1, but the district as a the county as a whole. So it's very important that, you know, people are able to live so they don't continue to move to Broward County and other parts of the, you know, of the state of Florida. And so that's one of the things. I also work for transit a little bit. I also work for Miami-Dade Aviation as well.
So let's hit on what we're going to hit on a couple of these topics, housing and transit. I want to start with the issue of gun violence because it's played such an important part of your life for because of a sad tragedy. And I wanted you, first of all, just to explain to people so they know about the Trayvon Martin Foundation and what you've been doing with the foundation over the years.
So one of the things that I, you know, pride myself on is just staying focused on what I need to do. So, of course, a lot of people know about my tragedy that happened with my son, Trayvon Martin, but I want to turn that pain into purpose. And that's what I've done. I make sure that I reached out to other families who are victims of senseless gun violence. And I want to bring change because I understand how those parents feel. So that's just one thing that, you know, amongst others that I want to make sure that I bring to the table. Through the Trayvon Martin Foundation, we've created a scholarship program where we send two students to college and we give them grant money for them to pay for their education while they're in school. And so that's very important. We award that each year, once in the fall and once in the spring. And so, you know, we're very proud of that program. We have a back to school event. I have another event that I'm, you know, very proud of, and that's the Circle of Mothers. I bring mothers in from all over the United States who are victims of senseless gun violence, who have a child that died through senseless gun violence. And we come together, we grieve, we laugh, we cry, we hug, we do all of those things that women do. You know, it's really personal, you know, and that's why I don't do much advertising. But most of the high profile families that you've heard of course, have been to the Circle of Mothers. But it's about bonding. It's about knowing that you have someone on your side, that you're not going through this tragedy alone, because we all have experienced gun violence, or we know somebody that experienced gun violence.
If you win this election, you take that seat, what can you do? How do you address the issue of gun violence now as a politician? And again, District 1, just to remind people, includes Miami Gardens, Opa-locka, and some of the hardest hit places for gangs and gun violence. But in that position, what could you do?
I think one of the things that I see, which is a fault of most career politicians, is they brush across what the problem is. They brush across what the fact that there is gun violence in the area, and that it comes on the news and we see it on a daily basis. And as a resident of Miami-Dade County, as a resident of District 1, I see it all the time, and I'm frightened by it. I'm scared by it. I don't want to attend certain events because of so much gun violence in that area. One of the things that I would do is get to the core of the problem. If the core of the problem is if gang related, if the core of the problem is people coming from outside the area, coming into the area, we need to find out what the core of the problem is. Other residents that are shooting other residents of Miami Gardens or District 1, then we need to find out what those issues are. If it's retaliation, we need to find out. We need to identify the issues first. And I think instead of covering things up and we continue to see it, it does no good for the community.
Commissioner Barbara Jordan, who's in that seat now, she's term limited, along with Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez, they announced a $2 million plan to combat gun violence in the county. And part of it is enforcement of a curfew. They also want more officers in the streets, and they want direct outreach with gang members. Let me start with the first part, though. A curfew. Do you think that would be effective?
I think anything that we can do that will decrease gun violence is a plus. I think if we have the kids in by a certain time and we see that works, we just need something that's different, something that's a change, because the way that things are being done is not working. And so I commend them for even coming up with a plan such as a curfew or enforcing the curfew. We can't just have the plan. We got to make sure we enforcing the curfew. And so if it makes me as a resident feel more comfortable, then I welcome the program that they have. I think it'll work, but we also have violence in the daytime as well. So we got to make sure we're addressing the problem. We can't just say, okay, everything happens in the evening, everything happens at night, because it doesn't. Sometimes broad daylight, some people are being shot, some people are being killed, they're being robbed, and those things are happening. Those crimes are happening in the daytime. And so what do we do about those? We have to identify the problems and not just cover them up.
You know, they also talked about having more officers on the streets, but right now, what do you see, and what you know, how do you feel about the way law enforcement, I guess, has been dealing with this issue over the years?
I think law enforcement in that particular area or anywhere, they deal with what they have. They're really just getting by on what they have. I think additional officers will help that community. I think if the officers also meet with the school age kids and start meeting with people in the community, start meeting with people that own businesses in that area, I think people will feel more comfortable. And just by having the officers more visible, I think that would help. That would definitely help. But just the officers getting to know the community a little better and the community getting to know the officers. We can't just blame it and say, okay, it's the police officers and that's the issue. I don't believe that. You know, I think the community has a part as well. And I think the community needs to get to know the officers. So they need to have a collaborative effort. Like the community needs to be more knowledgeable. And so the police officers need to be a little more knowledgeable about the community.
You know, in your travels, because you've had the chance to go around the country, have you seen a community where you look at them and say, we should be doing that? Have you seen anything?
Well, I don't
like
have to go very far. I can go right here in Aventura. When I go there to go to the mall, I'm not worried about being robbed. I'm not worried about being shot. And they don't even have that many police officers in that, you know, in that particular area. I'm not concerned with that. But when I do go into certain areas in North Dade, yes, I am concerned with that. And I think that's the census of most residents in Miami-Dade County, is that, you know, they feel like, okay, I can't go to the ATM. I can't go to the bank. I can't pump gas. At least that's the consensus of women. We don't want to do those things because we don't want to be afraid. I don't want to feel like I have to carry a gun everywhere I go. A gun should be optional to anybody. I have a right to feel safe in my own neighborhood, you know. But as I travel, there are some cities that I feel comfortable. I feel like they are safe, you know.
Again, we're talking with Sabrina Fulton. She's the mother of Trayvon Martin and the director of the Trayvon Martin Foundation. She is also a candidate for the Miami-Dade County Commission District 1 seat. She's running against Miami Gardens Mayor Oliver Gilbert. Again, that is a Barbara Jordan seat, and she is term limited out. You have a tough challenger in Mayor Gilbert in terms of fundraising. He has outpaced you by a wide margin. How are you going to close that gap when it comes to fundraising?
I'm going to work very hard. I just made the announcement on May 20th, so I only have a few weeks under my belt, but I got a good start, and I'm just going to work very hard and just try to convince people that if you want the same thing you've been receiving, if you want the same government, if you want the same career politicians, then that's who you need to vote on. If you want change and you want to make a difference in your community and see some type of improvement and be safe, feel safe in your community, then I'm the person for them.
Now, obviously, he had announced going back earlier, way earlier this year. And I mean, you're talking about the gap is almost 200,000 plus. But I mean, why did you decide now? How long was that process in making the decision for you?
The process was almost a year. I was asked last year about Because we have the documentary and also a book called Rest in Power, The Enduring Life of Trayvon Martin. And so I kind of been on tour with the book. And then the following year, which was last year, 2018, I was on tour with a documentary. And that question came up. And at the time I was thinking about running, I just didn't know what seat I wanted to run for. So I would just tell people, simply tell them that, you know, I'm doing my homework. I'm doing my research. I want to see what's out there. And so a year later, in April, I was speaking with a group of mothers in New York for National Action Network, which is Reverend Sharpton's convention. And I said that as an activist, as a community activist, you have to act. You have to sign petitions. You have to write letters. You have to make calls. You have to do rallies, and you have to run for office. You may have to run for office. And when I said it, something clicked in my body, in my mind, and I felt it. And so I just brushed it off. And then I spoke to a group of kids at a college in Pittsburgh the following month. And I said it again. I said, as an activist, sometimes you have to act. So you might have to write petitions. You might have to sign petitions. You might have to do rallies. You might have to make calls, write letters, you know, or you may have to run for office. And that was the second time I felt that same feeling. And so I had prayed about it, like I said, a year ago. And that was my sign that I was ready to run. So I told no one about it. I just came home. I met with family members and close friends, and I told them what seat. And the reason why I decided on Miami-Dade County Commissioner is because of my years of experience with Miami-Dade County. I feel like I came from the employee perspective. Now I'm coming from the residents' perspective.
Let's talk about a couple of the issues that you're going to be facing, issues for your community. I mean, your district encompasses some of the poorest neighborhoods. Now, we just had a conversation about this Miami Herald series about being priced out of paradise and how housing is just getting out of hand. But for your community, what would a Commissioner Fulton do in trying to bring some of the economic boom that we're seeing in all these other communities to your district? What would you do?
A lot of times people talk about economic development and they talk about new buildings coming up and they talk about jobs, but they're not talking about jobs that actually pay money in order for you to support yourself. That is a major concern for most average residents like myself. Like, I want to make sure that I'm making enough money so that I can pay my bills, so that I can take care, so I can have a place to stay, I can have a car to drive and all of those things. So I think the jobs that we've been seeing are not making enough money in order for them to support themselves. And that's why they're saying that it's a problem with affordable housing in that area, because we're just not making it affordable for people to live in that area. So they have to move elsewhere. They may come there and work, but they can't actually live in that area. And right, that makes a difference. You want to be able to support yourself with the income if you live right there in that area. And so I think that's one of the problems that I see amongst other problems.
To attract good jobs.
Absolutely. We have to do a little more training. Maybe we need to train some more people and make sure that they're able to make these. I'm not saying just give people jobs, but I'm saying, yeah, provide the training for these people and then give them to the positions if they qualify for it.
And the other thing, of course, is housing. So, you know, we just keep seeing more and more buildings. Housing keeps going up. And then, of course, it starts to push into all these other neighborhoods, and then you hear the word gentrification, but it starts to push people out. What do we do about that?
Working with Miami-Dade County Housing for so many years, I wrote policies and procedures, and then I did hearings for public housing in Section 8. And then lastly, I worked with the residents of Scott Carver that they had moved out. And so I brought these residents back in, had a series of meetings with them in order to get them to move back into this new development. And so one of the things that I notice is a lot of times people get so confused when you don't take them through the full process. So I think that's one of the things have to be explained to people so they understand it. You know, you can't talk over their heads. You need to talk to them so that they understand what they're getting themselves into. I think the housing developments that they have, like apartment buildings that is contingent upon your income, meaning if you make a lot of money, you're able to pay a certain amount. If you're not making that much money, it's impossible for you to pay that amount. So I think they need to make it more affordable. It's called mixed income housing, and you have some different mixed incomes in that same development.
Well, part of it is going to be putting the pressure on developers to create those. And they're just, hey, they see dollar signs.
Well, one thing they can be offered is tax credits, of course, and that'll, you know, pull people into moving into their developments. But I think a lot of times we just have to make it affordable for people. People want to have their own place. They want to live somewhere. Another component is not just rentals, but also home ownership. I think that's very important, because when you're renting something, you take care of it a certain way. But when you own it, you really take care of it. You really try to make a difference. You try to make it look nice. You try to upgrade it and do those things because you know you're going to be there. And so I think we need to look into home ownership and trying to find money for people as far as down payments, as far as straightening their credit, and find out exactly.
State money, federal money?
Federal money. It could be federal money. It could be local money. But at the same time, I think we just have to help residents so that they can get into those homes.
Let me finish with this. You're speaking to the voters right now. What do you tell them about who you are? This is the chance to introduce yourself to them.
Well, one thing I want to tell residents is that I'm for the people. I may not speak the language of a politician because I don't feel myself as a politician. I feel myself as a regular resident that's trying to help the residents of District 1. And so I just want to be their spokesperson. I have been a spokesperson for my son for the last 7 years. And through the Trayvon Martin Foundation, I have done amazing things through the Trayvon Martin Foundation. But I want to give back to my community. I want to start right at home. I want to give back to my community. I want to make sure some of the things that need to be addressed, like transportation, that they're being addressed. I can look at it with a fresh new pair of eyes. I'm not looking at it as a politician and saying, okay, well, it's business as usual. I want to know why some things have not occurred. I want to know why some improvements are not in certain areas. I want to know why some things have not been investigated. And so I speak for the people. And so one of the things that I'm going to make sure I do even before I get in office is meet with a lot of residents, because I want to hear their concerns. I know that I have problems with my taxes. They're too high. I have problems with traffic. It's too much traffic. I have problems with me feeling safe in my own community. And so do they. But I want to listen to our elderly residents. I want to know from them, do you have enough programs? I want to know from the kids, do you have enough summer programs? And that's a big deal.
Sabrina Fulton, she is, again, one of the two candidates running for Miami-Dade County Commission District 1. Her opponent, Miami Gardens Mayor Oliver Gilbert. Lots of time before the election. Love to have you back so we can talk about more of those. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, we're going to talk about why Miami-Dade and Broward deal with such high rates of HIV cases and what we could do about that. It's coming up next here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Miami and Fort Lauderdale have the highest rates of new HIV diagnosis relative to anywhere else in the country. This according to data from the Centers for Disease Control. The local nonprofit Prevention 305 is taking a unique approach to get the message of safe sex and STD testing to as many people as possible. They're connecting with vulnerable populations on social media and dating apps. Marco Torriabla is Prevention 305's program director, and he joins me now. Marco, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Hey, how are you? Thank you very much for having us today and talking about this important topic for the Miami community and Broward community.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And also joining us is David Jobin. He is the CEO of the nonprofit Our Fund, and the organization raises funds for LGBTQ organizations around South Florida. And by the way, last night they had an award ceremony. I'll ask them about that in a second. David, thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
All right. Let me start with this. David, tell us about the scope, real quickly, of the number of nonprofits that are working in the LGBTQ space here in South Florida and how it's changed over the years.
think people would be surprised at the number of organizations and the kind of the breadth of the work that they're doing. You know, oftentimes when we think of LGBT nonprofits, we think of community centers. We think of LGBT community centers. But really, the reality is that there's so much more than that. And beyond the agencies that we're here to talk about today that are doing the important HIV/AIDS work, there's also cultural organizations. There's organizations that look at the interests of LGBT women. There's a number of transgender organizations that support the rights and of transgender individuals living in South Florida. So I think people would be surprised at just how many, the number of organizations, and the good work that they're doing.
Our fund, by the way, you're based in Wilton Manors.
We're at the heart of it all.
And, you know, I mean, look, but some people may remember a few months ago, police department rolled out rainbow-colored vehicles
right. In
Wilton Manors. Wilton Manors was transformed really from this little Broward suburb community into really this important community for the LGBTQ.
Right.
How?
Do you know, we've done a little bit of research on this. There was an educator and went into the Stonewall Archives in South Florida, and he realized and recognized that there was kind of a migration from Miami Beach to Wilton Manors. A lot of it had to do with the price of homes. Homes in Wilton Manors were considerably more affordable than in Miami Beach, but it also was based around one club. There was a club called Steve's Alibi. That's still in Wilton Manors, and that was a popular destination for people from Miami Beach. And I think they came and thought, why don't we just make a go of it here?
So I've heard that. I mean, that one club really shaped
right.
Wilton Manors.
It's the largest concentration of LGBT households in the country.
Margaret, your organization is in part financed, I believe, by our fund, right, in HELP?
Yes, we are part of the new grantees that our fund is helping to find ways to help people.
Tell us briefly about Population 305. What is it? Or Prevention, excuse me, 305. What is it?
Prevention 305, we are technically a referral agency, and what we do is help people to have access to pre-exposure prophylaxis, post-exposure prophylaxis, condoms, HIV testing, or treatment as prevention, okay? The idea of all these HIV prevention tools is stop the high rates of HIV infections in Miami.
Right now, why are those rates so high? Is the education not there? Are we just not getting the message out enough?
There can be many possibilities. It can be education. It can be also that Miami is a city that have a lot of migrant population. People probably don't know that those services like free HIV testing and free treatment are free, as I'm saying. So there can be many, many issues. But I think one thing that can help all this situation is start talking openly about HIV prevention tools. Like, for instance, it's time for schools to open the doors for all these topics, for all these conversations.
Have you had a chance to talk to anybody in the schools about trying to open up that conversation?
Broward, I know that Broward has like a very active participation in HIV prevention and education. Miami is still being very conservative about the schools.
Now, I mentioned dating app, using a dating app to try to open that conversation and talk about education. Help me understand how that works.
Yeah, well, technically what we do is we have a profile, like a real person, a real profile. We have peer navigators located in different areas of the city of Miami, especially in those zip codes that were, according to AIDS View, there are more people living with HIV. For that reason, probably the risk of infection is higher. So we have people in these dating apps that some people use it for love, some other people use it because they just want to have sex with someone. So we approach in a very proactive way. We approach people and we tell them, hey, we are for Prevention 305, or hey, my name is Marco, my name is Eduardo, my name is Daniel, my name is David. So I work for Prevention 305 and I can help you to have access to pre-exposure prophylaxis PrEP, or condoms, or free HIV testing. Many people on the dating apps still don't know what PrEP means.
And that's PEP, P-E-P,
P-R-E-P.
Oh, P-R-E-P, PrEP, yeah. Okay. And so tell them real quick what it is.
Yeah, pre-exposure prophylaxis is a pill that you can take once a day to keep the HIV away. Okay, in order to be able to have access to pre-exposure prophylaxis, you have to go to your PCP or any care center in Miami, get tested for HIV, know that your HIV status is negative, and then you can have access to PrEP with insurance, without insurance, and regardless of the migratory status. Because Why we say migratory status? Because it can change at any moment.
Right.
So you shouldn't stop yourself to have access to care.
How has it been working with the dating apps?
We are doing great. So far, we have helped more than 400 people to have access to pre-exposure prophylaxis in just 1 year and a half.
So the dating app is actually reaching people. It's because people are on it.
Yes. It's basically, you have to find people where they are.
David, I mean, I guess that's the future of engagement, is reach people where they are. And this is where they are. They're on their phone. They're on apps.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, tell us a little bit about, you know, what you think that data application is going to mean for the future. Maybe is that really where we have to go?
You know, I think when Prevention 305 first came to our fund for a grant, we found this to be a really unique approach. You know, I go back to the days when all of the information about HIV and AIDS was printed on a poster above a urinal at a gay bar. And I think that they've really advanced the conversation and going on hookup sites. We found that to be really innovative. And at our fund, you know, we're bringing philanthropists to the table, and it's going to take some innovation to really figure out this problem that we have here in Miami-Dade and Broward County. So Prevention 305 for us was a breath of fresh air.
Again, I'm talking with David Jobin, the CEO of Our Fund in Wilton Manors, which fundraises for LGBTQ organizations in South Florida. And they're supporting groups like Prevention 305, which raises awareness about HIV prevention and provides free STD testing and medication. Marco Torreable is the program director for Prevention 305. They're both joining me now here in studio. David, your organization, again, responsible for fundraising, the fundraising portion of the work. How do you get folks inspired to get involved in this fight in combating AIDS, HIV? Because, look, we think about this, the fight started back in the 80s.
Right.
People have seemed to have a different attitude, or is that just me? What do you think about how people view the issue? When you say HIV, how do they react?
You know, I think people think it's solved. And I'm especially talking about older gay male donors. And these are the donors who were on the forefront of funding HIV/AIDS causes in the late 80s and early 90s. And once the government stepped in and started to direct resources to this, and once there started to be protease inhibitors and the drugs seemed to be fixing this, I'm concerned that our gay donors walked away from this. They stepped away. You know, so much of philanthropy is about empathy. And it started to look different than their population. And now the challenge is, how do we bring them back?
Marco.
Yes.
People think that it's solved, and so they just don't want to bother with it. They think it's been resolved and there's no more issue.
Well, there are always differences inside the community. There are always like different inputs. For instance, we have to be aware that when we talk about dating apps and reaching out the community, we are helping those who are more in need, those who don't have access to education, those who don't have access to care system. It can be people who are moving to Miami, immigrants, Black African-American community. So I think that is what David has been saying about empathy. We have to show like kind of the love that we feel for them. We have to integrate these people in the care system.
How much of this, by the way, how much of the challenge is cultural? I wondered if you see a different attitude in the Latin gay community compared to the Black gay community, compared to, I mean, any group.
Yeah, of course. We are all different. That's part of the like diverse. But usually Latinos, we see and we speak about sex like in a different way the Black African American community does, and also white people in Miami. So technically, yeah, we have like a lot of cultural differences, especially the language. The way we speak, just not about Spanish or English, is the way we communicate among each other. So that's the most challenging part.
Where do you see the greatest challenge right now, though, as you move forward, again, trying to spread the education? Where's the biggest challenge? I don't know. It sounded almost like trying to talk to schools, to talk to kids about the issues.
Yes, because when you talk to kids, you are stopping any issue or any problem already that you're going to have already in the future. So you're going to have to include, Miami have to include the teenager population in this conversation about HIV prevention tools. And also, as Evie was saying, everyone can be affected for HIV or for any STI. So I think this is something that it should bring Miami together.
David, I'll give you the last word. What do you see the greatest challenge as we move forward?
I think the greatest challenge for us at our fund is making certain that our donor base understands that this cause really looks very much like it did in the 80s and 90s. We're still talking about the MSM community. We're talking about men who are having sex with men being affected by this. And how do we bring those resources back to the table?
And that it's not resolved.
Right.
Don't think that it's been resolved. Again, we've been talking with David Jobin, CEO of our fund in Wilton Manors, again, which fundraises for LGBTQ organizations in South Florida, and Marco Doriable, Program Director for Prevention 305. You can learn more about the group and about the work that they're doing on our social media at WLRN Sundal. David, Marco, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being an open window for us.
Absolutely. Thank you. And that's our program for this Thursday, June 13th. Have a great Friday. Have a great weekend. I'm Luis Hernandez. We'll talk to you again on Monday.